Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hi everyone, it's Imogen, the voice of Imogen from Stella Firma. Today I'm here to tell you about Woebegone, a podcast launched on the RQ Network. Woebegone is a weekly horror sci-fi audio drama series about the nature of power and the implications of linear time. Woebegone follows Mike Waters, who discovers a mysterious and violent online game. What begins as an exploration of an alternate reality game with real-life consequences quickly becomes a search for the technology that makes the game possible. Each episode has a unique soundtrack composed by creator and writer Dylan Griggs. Listen to Woebegone, that's Woe, full stop, Begone, wherever you listen to podcasts, or check out woebegonepod.com for episodes and transcripts. Have fun and see you later.
Hi everyone, Alex here. I'd just like to take a moment to thank some of our patrons. Ben Hinder, Amanda, Raw Granavang, Julia Duffy, Linus T, Emma Steiner, Josh, Jill Kozo, Emily Goodrich, Wrong Cello, Rowan Enjol Radical, Paul Gregory, Alex Self, Zyker, Panko, Ali Martins, Kat, Sabrina Howes, Nawal Dark. Thank you all. We really appreciate your support. If you'd like to join them, go to www.patreon.com/rustyquill and take a look at our rewards.
Hello and welcome to today's episode of Stella Firma. This is a little different to the normal Stella Firma episodes. We are not meeting with Trexel and David Seven today. Instead, I am here with Tim Meredith.
Hello.
And Ben Meredith.
Hello.
Who, of course, are the two stars of our show, to talk about the science of Stella Firma, whether there is any, what they know, and most definitely what they don't know.
No, nothing, everything. Right, yeah. Show's over.
So, done.
Oh, cool, that was quick. Yeah. All right, we'll cut the recording there. No one needs to hear anymore. I am Bryn Monroe. I am a member of the Rusty Quill Gaming Podcast, which is why I'm here today, because basically I know these reprobates from way back. I think I've been brought on to host this very special episode due to the fact that many, many years ago now, I studied theoretical physics.
You're a science
at
boy,
university.
Aren't you? You're a science boy.
I am very much a science boy, with a specialism absolutely in cosmology, and my master's dissertation was on the thermodynamic properties of black holes. So, as you can imagine, there have been several points during the first season of Stella Firma when I've winced heavily while listening. And we're going to see how many of those I can remember today and talk about what thought has gone into these episodes.
Sure. Would you like me to do my bona fides?
Yeah, me too.
Oh, yeah. Let's get some credentials from the two Meredith brothers.
Ben, do you want to start with your credentials?
Okay, then. Yes.
Okay.
So I am Ben Meredith, B-A-M-A. I think the M-A just replaces the B-A. I actually don't know how it works. But my B-A is in English Literature and my M-A is in Creative and Critical Writing. So lots of science in there.
Mm. Oh, yeah.
Mm. Mm. The science of language.
Mm. That's linguistics and
it's
not what
thing.
I did.
Not even that.
Nope.
My name is Tim Meredith and I did a B-A in politics. You could do a Bachelor's of Science, but I chose not to.
Nice. If I have to state my formal qualifications, then BA Ons, MA Cantab, MSc, probably something else too that I'm forgetting. But I don't think that's terribly important. The important bit is my high-level knowledge of cosmology and very specifically black holes. But black holes really aren't the focus of Stella Firma. The focus of Stella Firma, I'm pretty sure Trexel stressed this heavily in the very first episode, is that Stella Firma designs planets. Not moons.
Not moons.
Not solar systems. Planets.
Unless we design a moon, in which case sometimes moons.
Sometimes moons, but mostly as an add-on to a planet.
You wouldn't
design a moon all by itself.
It's like building a conservatory. You know, people do it, but it doesn't make you an architect. It just makes you, a glass merchant.
Sure. Okay, so I think my first question for the two of you is what do you think a planet is?
That sounds like a trick question, and I'm
proud. Yeah, I was going to say that. Pretty sure I know the answer.
Every question I ask is going to be a trick question on some level, guys.
Should we both give our thoughts, or do we want to take them in turn? Like, I'll do one and Ben will do one.
I think the normal chaos produced from the meeting of your two minds will do just fine.
Well, I'll shout then. So my thoughts are, I think a planet is a big collection of matter around a single point, and it's gone hard. And then sometimes, no. Okay, so my understanding is you've got a big load of dust, like you've got just dust that's from somewhere, and some of the dust is more in one place than the rest of the dust, and so it's got a little tiny bit of gravity, and then more dust goes. Well, that's where the party's happening, and so that gets there, and then that naturally increases the gravity, and they're like, "Whoa, guys, have you seen that dust? Come over here," and then that just sort of gets really out of hand until all the dust.
Sure. I mean, you're talking about the planet creation process here.
Yeah.
When I say what do you think a planet is, what I mostly mean is how do scientists classify what's a star, what's a planet, what's a moon,
what's a comet?
Yeah, you go.
What's a dwarf planet?
Sure. So I think a planet is a celestial object above a certain size which orbits or has a sustained orbit around a star.
Sounded confident.
That's the basic definition. To be classified as a planet, there are a few other criteria though, which you've sort of touched on there. So one of the really important ones is the orbit. So it's got to be orbiting a star. If it's orbiting another planet, or, well, a star system, technically, because you can have binary and trinary stars. But importantly, you're right that the planet has to be a certain size. It also has to be a certain regularity of orbit. If the orbit is not basically roughly circular, then it does not meet the requirement to be classified as a planet.
So is there therefore no such thing as a rogue planet? Because as soon as it sort of starts to get out of hand, it loses its planet privileges. And it's like, you're just a lump now.
Essentially, yes. at that point, it becomes a comet or an asteroid or, a rogue planet is very much a... We've got an interesting thing here, because there's obviously the classifications known to science and the classifications known to science fiction. Sure. And there is some overlap. They don't necessarily always mesh perfectly. So a rogue planet is much more of a science fiction content. You know, I don't know what a scientist would call it. Probably something silly like a roaming astronomical body. They wouldn't... But yeah, it's technically... not a planet.
Sure.
So how many of the planets we've allegedly designed in season one of Stella Firma do you think meet the technical scientific definition of a planet?
Probably none.
Because I don't think we often talk about... I think there's maybe a couple of mentions of one of our quote-unquote planets orbiting something, but that doesn't often come up. Like, they're normally just sort of hanging in just sort of space.
This is something I've always wondered. I mean, what in your minds, what is the sort of the backstory behind Stella Firma? When a client is coming to Stella Firma with a request for a planet, do they already have a star? Are you also providing the star?
Well, I assume the build team just works with that.
Do you just know a bunch of stars?
It's like...
So you're making the stars as well as the planets?
I don't think... It's like if you were building a house, you wouldn't also have to build the school that it's nearby in order to give amenities, or like build the water grid. You know, like we're using the stars as they are, and then you just like pitch up and boom, there's a planet.
The star is more like the ground that the house sits on in this metaphor,
the space
basically.
You're right, Bryn. It's the space ground. Thank you.
It is the space ground, yeah. So you've got to have your star before you can have your planet. So you need to own. I presume you need to own a star system where you want the planet to
or,
go.
You know, you rent your spot, like a parking space.
Yeah.
Or maybe you could have that whole thing where people who own like static trailers own the trailer but not the ground, and then one day they sell the trailer park, and it's like, cool, get your house out of here, and that sort of thing.
Just suddenly the sun implodes and
get your planet out of here, buddy.
Yeah, suns imploding is a big problem, I imagine, for Stellar, old Stellar Firma Limited.
It really affects the property values. It really hits them hard. Yeah. It does. It's a shame.
One of the things that has come up in a few different, very much in the earlier recordings, is we discussed potential sizes and shapes for planets as well. And it seemed to me that as we got further through the season, you guys stopped worrying so much about the size and the shape of the planets you were designing.
They stopped worrying about a lot of things, I think, as things went on. Ben, what did we definitely had a scale really early on. And I think it might have been along the lines of small one, a little bit bigger, pretty big, quite big and really big. Is that roughly how we classified them?
Whatever the scale was, it was vague and unremembered.
Yeah, a vague and unremembered scale.
And obviously, you mentioned, Ben, that a planet technically has to be of a certain size to meet the definition of a planet. But I think we can assume that all Stellar Firma's basic planet shapes meet that definition.
I definitely say that the planets that Trexel makes trend towards the big, because there's just always a lot of stuff on them.
Yeah. Well, I mean, go big or go home. Is always tattooed on my legs.
And it's what he says when he orders a triple at the Cosmic Lounge.
Yes, and then I drop the glass. Although I do think the first one we ever did was explicitly, after all that moon chat and all that planet chat, I think the first thing we did was a trough moon, and I may have yelled... I've yelled trough moon quite a bit, so I'm nothing if not inconsistent.
I think there is an issue here, though, which is basically that the human brain really is bad at comprehending the size of a planet, because... I mean, Earth is pretty average as the size of a planet goes. And I mean, I've listened to every single episode. I love the show. Big fan.
It would be awkward if you said, I listened to three and it's not for me.
There would be. I mean, I got to suggest one of the planets.
You did.
We'll meet that one later. Obviously, I have a lot of extra thoughts about the one that came from my Patreon suggestion. Planets are big, y'all. I mean, it's just, there's so much space. And I don't think that any of the designs I remember covered the scale. I mean, think about our planet. Like, have you described enough stuff to fill up all of North America, all of Africa, all of Russia?
I think, Bryn,
in an episode?
What you have to consider is, have you ever thought about how big any of the things we're suggesting are? Because...
That's a good point.
They're real big. You know, we say a mall, that's a continent. We say a wrestling ring, it's probably the size of Belgium. So...
You can't see the other side of the ring because of the curvature of the Earth. That's how big we're talking here.
I see. That wasn't clear to me. I'll retract that.
You know,
we
don't even know how big the people who are asking us for their planets are.
That's true. This is a question. This is going to sound very stupid, even as I think about it, but I've started, so I'll finish. Is there... to do with a planet size, then a natural height to which things can go before they poke out of the atmosphere and it gets ridiculous? Is there some sort of relationship between the size of the planet and how tall things are allowed to be on them? Because otherwise things are going to start getting into the thing. Like, the tallest animals that ever existed... if you were on too small a planet, would it be like, well, you can't have animals that big because they're so tall that their heads will poke out the top of the atmosphere and it'll be all sort of suffocating?
Well, I mean, that's a really interesting question.
Isn't it?
Yeah, I like that question. The amount of atmosphere on a planet is related to its size and its density, because its density and its size together give you its mass, which affects how strong the gravity is. But it's not the only factor. So, like, you've got, for example, if you look at the three planets, Venus, Earth and Mars, they're all roughly the same size. Mars is a little bit smaller than the other two, but they've got very different atmospheres. Yeah. So Earth is the atmosphere we're used to. Mars has almost no atmosphere. Now, it does have one, but it's so much thinner. It's like... if you're standing on the surface of Mars, it's like being twice as high as Everest or something. You know, the consistency of the air is so thin that you basically can't notice that it has any. But it's not quite as bad as, say, the vacuum of space. So, you know, if you build a colony on Mars, you don't have to worry about explosive decompression to quite the same extent.
Right.
Venus has a really thick atmosphere, so it's in fact larger than Earth because it's got there's so much gas around Venus, and it, you know, the atmosphere stretches further from the surface of the planet. So... you know, if we were professional planet designers, as two of you play on TV, we would have to consider audio TV. You're not a planet designer, you just play one on TV.
Yeah.
We'd have to consider this kind of thing. We'd have to consider what sort of atmosphere we were putting on these planets. It's not a discussion I don't think I've ever heard the two of you have.
No. Well, we would do if we didn't only have 20 minutes to design a planet.
That's true.
Although we can't use that as a consistent excuse for any of our... Well, we only have 20 minutes. Like, well, yes, but that's my fault.
I mean, if Trexel would just turn up on time for once...
Well, exactly.
I keep asking him.
You know, this isn't just about Trexel. I actually asked Tim to turn up. We have an eight-hour recording session. This isn't a thing.
I would pay so much money for an eight-hour... episode of Stella Firma. That would make me so happy.
Die. The wheels would come off so quickly.
Knowing how the two of you would suffer recording it.
Then I'd have to actually eat like some kind of awful porridge.
Yeah, quiet porridge that doesn't turn up on the audio.
No, I mean like clone slurry, because we'd have to be eating in character. We'd have to go to the toilet, at which point, remember, David can't get out of the room, so we'd have to get some sort of camping like toilet.
Pretty sure in one episode you suggested that the chairs in the room also are able to act as toilets.
Yeah, but the chairs in our studio aren't.
No.
No. Oh, that's
we'd
a good point.
We'd have to craft point, special chairs, special toilet chairs. Or commission. Do you think we can expense that? Ask Alex. Ask Alex if we can expense toilet chairs.
He's nodding. I mean, he's crying, but he's nodding.
There you go.
I mean, the other super important consideration for any planet, along with the size, which you have at least paid lip service to, is how dense you want the planet, you know, because that affects its gravity, which affects literally everything that happens on the planet, including the consistency of its atmosphere, the inhabitants' ability to move and not collapse under their own weight just by being placed on the surface, which, I'm not sure is something you've paid a lot of attention to in the episodes.
Well, a lot of our planets are, if not hollow, there's certainly a lot going on in them, because I think one was a big safe.
Yep.
In which there were civilizations within civilizations within civilizations all living in the mechanisms. And therefore, whilst the, you know, let's say the safe is made of metal, that there's also going to be so much air that even if it's quite a dense metal, the fact that there's so many gaps means that it's all going to average out to, let's say, like limestone. So there's you have to sort of take that into account.
So are we using the planet's natural gravitational field, or does Stella Firma build gravitational technology into every planet? Do we have some sort of super sci-fi tech that can control the gravity independent of the actual mass of the planet?
I think that's an added extra. That's got it, because like there's the old person's planet, and I don't know if we ended up putting it in, but we definitely talked about gravity regulation and sort of turning it up and down and.
I remember that one. Yes,
shifting.
Yes.
Although, you know what? I think in the end, the way we got around that wasn't by generating gravity. It was by teleporting the planet around to near and farther away from different stars in different situations.
No.
Which would mean that whilst the gravity did change, it would change the gravity towards. But it would change the gravity.
That wouldn't change the gravity. That's not on the planet. Not how gravity works.
But
no,
it would change the gravity towards the star. So it's like in here, the gravity's changed. So you all fall off the planet in one direction towards the star, which is
that's also not how that works.
Is that not how that works?
No.
Well, how does it work, Mr.
Not
Science?
How that works.
Go on. So, okay, I've got a question for you, Bryn,
please.
Captain Maths. So, okay, let's take orbit out of it, because I appreciate that the orbit is a lot of it. But let's just say you've got a planet in its stationary. I know that means it's not a planet, Bryn, but bear with me. So let's say you've got a stationary rogue astronomical body, and you've got it next to, let's say, a regular-sized sun. And by regular-sized sun, I mean our sun, because I'm sunnist.
Sure.
So you've got it there, and that's sort of a regular gravity. So you take that rogue astronomical body, and you don't change anything about it other than it's now next to a much, much larger sun with, therefore, a much higher gravity. So whilst I appreciate that part of it will be that the planet will fall into it, before that, is it possible that it could, like, pull people off of it out into space? Like, if you have a sudden, like, gravity-creating object? No. Why? Answer me that.
So the gravitational force on any object is governed by two things. The mass that is causing the gravitational force.
And love.
And it's... and its distance from that mass. And so if you're on the surface of a planet, the gravitational pull on you from the centre of the planet is always going to be much stronger than any nearby star, because although the star is potentially millions or billions of times larger in terms of mass, it is... for life to even exist upon this theoretical planet, it's also got to be far enough away that the gravitational pull of the star is less than that of the planet.
Otherwise, it just wouldn't be in the first place.
Exactly. Yeah. And yeah, and the planet can't be stationary. Like
I told you to allow me that, Bryn. What did I say?
Yes, absolutely.
I appreciate that.
What do you guys think that the star does affect about a planet? So in the very first episode, we definitely didn't create a planet. We created, I think it ended up being referred to as a trough moon.
Yep. It is a trough moon, which is in the Stella Firma company handbook, class as a planet. So
yes,
check
mate. Yes. I mean, obviously, science hasn't had to classify non-spherical or non-approximately spherical objects. So, you know, at least in theory, it wouldn't meet the definition of a planet. But I think we're so far outside the realm of current scientific understanding that we can just sort of shrug and accept it.
Yeah, we're just way ahead of you, really.
Wasn't there a cigar comet?
Yes. So comets can be much more irregularly shaped than planets.
Sure. Because they're
funky. Yeah, and asteroids even more so. A comet tends to be relatively regularly shaped because of the solar forces upon it. Whereas an asteroid, who knows? But so the trough moon, we did discuss things like day length and year length, which I think was possibly the only episode that happened in. But it made me very happy that you at least considered these factors. So how do we think that the day length and the year length relates to the properties of the planet and the star of which it's orbiting around?
Well, the year length is how long it takes to complete a full orbit, and the day length will be based on how fast the planet's spinning.
Yeah, I mean, that's absolutely.
I'm noticing a bit of a trend here of Ben calmly and succinctly answering questions correctly, which I'm not a fan of, given that thus far it's 2-0, and I feel like I'm being made a fool of. I don't want to be petty about this, but I will.
Okay, so well, a question to Tim then. What a follow-up question to Tim. What properties of the star and the planet control how long the planet takes to complete one single orbit? Any ideas?
I feel like Ben's question was easier, but okay.
I was going to say, to be fair, I have no idea. Answer away, Tim.
Okay, repeat the question to me. I'm going to really try and get this right.
So what properties of the star and the planet govern how long it takes the planet to complete one orbital cycle?
Oh, actually, sorry, I do know this one.
Yes, okay, I do know that. So it will be the mass of the planet itself and the gravity of the object it's orbiting around, because the greater the gravity, the faster the planet will have to be travelling in order to keep the orbit and not crash into the object, and that will affect the speed and so on and so forth.
Yes, so that's half right. You've got the important bit right. The mass of the planet actually doesn't matter.
Does it not?
No. There's several equations that apply to this situation, and when you put them all together to solve the relationship, the mass of the planet drops out of the equations. It ends up not affecting in the same way that all objects fall at the same rate.
Sure.
For the same reason, all planets orbit at the same speed, but it is very much affected by the mass of the star. So the mass of the star has a huge impact on how fast the planet goes around. But there is a second factor that plays into it as well,
which is the length of the orbit, right? Like the how far away the planet is from the star.
Yes, sure. Absolutely. So those are the two factors.
In the way that the center of a wheel is going much faster, is traveling much faster. Sorry,
exactly.
It's traveling much slower. Slower or faster? Gosh, the center
travels slower.
Slower, because it's got less far to go to complete a revolution.
Yes.
Consider the graph friend.
Consider the graph friend.
The graph friend.
Yeah. Yes. When you draw a small circle,
it goes really fast.
There you go.
It whooshes around, and then sometimes your pencil breaks, and then you chuck your pencil out. Yeah, I understand. I'm glad. Thank you, Ben, for bringing it down to my level.
So the mass of the star and the distance of the planet from the star, hugely important in determining the orbital cycle. The other thing that they have a huge impact on is the amount of energy that the star transfers to the planet. that energy being primarily in the forms of light and, more importantly, heat. So it's quite difficult, potentially, to balance those two competing needs. If you want to control the length of the year, the length of the single orbit, you've also got to think about what effect you're going to have on the climate of the planet, because the further you move it, as we can see in our own solar system, the colder a planet is going to get.
Well, that's as proven out in the review for that planet, something we did not consider because we made soup.
We did.
Absolutely. Boiling soup, as I recall.
The soup is one to be. Is this what's referred to as the Goldilocks zone?
Absolutely, yeah. Do you know what the Goldilocks zone is talking about? What is at the exact right temperature in the Goldilocks zone?
I'm going to say, well, now, the thing is, the temperature...
Is that surface temperature of the planet? Or like,
yeah,
because that
changes throughout the year. It's quite hot in England right now, but that doesn't mean that in winter life ceases to be.
Absolutely, and it's very different at different points on the planet. Our planet spins. It spins on an axis which is about 23 degrees off from directly perpendicular to its orbital motion, which creates seasons, but also creates cold spots and hot spots. And the temperature on the surface of our planet can vary by almost 100 degrees from the coldest spot to the hottest spot, I believe.
Really? I didn't know it was that much.
Well, so and I believe the depth of Antarctica can sometimes reach minus 60, and the hottest spots in like the Sahara Desert can reach 50 or 50 something. So it's slightly over 100 degrees variance between those two.
And I found out literally today that 37 degrees, but specifically 37 degrees on the wet bulb scale, which is both heat and humidity, is the point at which your humans are no longer able to regulate their body temperatures. So if it's on a special scale that I don't entirely understand, but humidity and heat above 37, your body can't cool you down fast enough because there's too much hot water in the air and you die.
Yes. Yeah, it's pretty nasty.
Pretty nasty.
For example, Antarctica is not always in the Goldilocks zone, whereas obviously the Earth as a whole is. So the Goldilocks zone is not, you know, a clear delineation of the whole planet must be exactly one temperature.
Yeah.
But it's saying that, you know, a significant portion of the planet is at the right temperature for 100% of the year, or significant portions are at the right temperature for 100% of the year in total. And the Goldilocks zone is referring to liquid water, basically, because that's, as far as we're aware, the most important factor involved in a planet being habitable.
Oh, so not so cold it's frozen and not so hot it's gas.
Exactly.
There you go.
So Venus, for example, is too hot, even though it's technically in the Goldilocks zone. Its atmosphere is so thick and heavy that all the water that exists there is gaseous. And Mars is also in the Goldilocks zone in terms of distance from the sun, but its atmosphere is so weak that all the water there has frozen. So the Goldilocks zone is a sort of a theoretical distance, but the practical distance is also affected by the planet's atmosphere.
So wait, if it's just liquid water, doesn't that mean you could have a planet in the Goldilocks zone that just has an average surface temperature of 70 degrees?
Yes.
Yes, because like bacteria, like extremophile bacteria, lives in like hot vents at the bottom of the ocean, which is, yeah, that kind of that. So it's like not mammals, sure, but something.
Oh, okay. Life. Yeah, Goldilocks is general to life. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, it's not a perfect description because obviously, yes, a planet which was 100%, you know, a semi-boiling sea would not be a great place for a human being to go on vacation.
But there would be some deep sea slugs that would be like, hot dang, this is for me.
Very hot.
Absolutely.
Dang.
Now, I believe we also, the Trough Moon, if I remember correctly, as well as one of the other planets, I can't remember which one it was. The Trough Moon, I believe, had a day that was equal to its year. And one of the other planets you mentioned always had the same face pointing towards the star. So it had a light side and a dark side.
Yes, the animal murder life gun planet.
The animal murder life gun planet.
That's its official title.
That was a very good one.
Planet number three? I can't remember if it's two or three. It was one of the early ones.
Yeah, yeah. It was in our blue period.
Now, that is actually a pretty common condition for an orbiting body to find itself in. It's known as being tidally locked, and the moon is actually tidally locked to the Earth.
Hence the Pink Floyd album.
Yes. Wish You Were Here. Well, desperately trying to remember a Pink Floyd album title. I got it.
Well, it's not... It's not quite a perfect thing, because obviously for the moon, it's tied a lot to the Earth, so it's got the same face always facing the Earth, but that's not a dark side and a light side, because the light is provided by the sun. So all points on the Earth, on the moon's surface eventually get some sunlight, but only one side of the moon ever gets any Earth light.
Sure. So is there... Okay, bear with me. So are there planets that are tidally locked and therefore it doesn't have a day? Like, there isn't a day, because a day is how long it takes to rotate, and it's not, so there is no day.
We believe so. There's none in our solar system. It seems to be quite a common
picks or it didn't
state.
Happen, Bryn. Picks or it
well,
didn't
indeed.
Happen.
We have discovered, as a species, something in the order of 400 to 500 exoplanets outside our solar system, but we don't know enough about them to establish whether tidally locked planets actually exist. But orbital simulations indicate that being tidally locked is quite a common state for an orbital body. So it seems likely that there are planets out there where, yeah, they essentially have a light side and a dark side rather than a day-night cycle. But it comes with its own host of problems because, as I said earlier, a sun is in charge of providing light and, much more importantly, heat to a planet. So what do you think happens when you've got a planet that is tidally locked to its sun and the key difference between the light side and the dark side?
One side's hot.
Yeah, one side's hot. Again, it feels like a trick question. It's like, well, because one side's always hot and the other's always cold, which is bad for some reason.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
It is very bad because we talked about the variation on the Earth's surface between temperature. On a tidally locked planet, that temperature variation is going to be huge. You're going to find it very, very difficult to have a planet which is habitable, because you're likely to get an incredibly hot side and an incredibly cold side. And here we're getting into some more planetary science rather than cosmology, which is not my area of expertise, but I do know a little.
Well, luckily it's ours, so you're covered.
Brilliant, brilliant. What happens if on a planet you've got an incredibly hot place and an incredibly cold place?
Does the temperature differential, snap it in half eventually? Like, if there's a cold side and a hot side, that means it will be expanding and contracting at different, rates. Like, the cold side's constantly getting more and more dense, and the hot side's getting more and more not dense. What's not dense? Loose? That sounds wrong. I genuinely don't know what the
sparse.
Word is. Sparse. That side's getting sparse. So, you basically have, a lumpy, weird planet that will eventually snap, when you pour boiling water into a glass and it smashes.
I hadn't considered that, actually. I think you'd have to have a very small, very solid planet for that to be a risk, but it
so
does sound exciting.
It's possible.
I'm honestly not sure.
I'm beyond science.
Any other guesses as to what atmospheric phenomena that our tidally locked planet might be witness to?
Wouldn't the atmosphere burn off?
A small risk, yeah. If the planet gets too hot, you're going to lose a lot more atmosphere to the cold, hard vacuum of space.
Will it all be on one side?
Half an atmosphere.
Actually, in a sense, yes, because the biggest problem, if you have a cold section and a hot section in a single room, what happens in the room?
It becomes warm. I'm in the middle. There's a cold bit and a hot bit, the middle of the room.
Are you talking about convection?
Points.
I am talking
Is
about
it
convection.
Wind? Is it get too windy?
It's now 3-0 to Ben. Just keeping score at home.
Damn it! hang on, didn't I get half a point? I believe I got half a point.
Oh, no, you did get half a point, you're right. It's 3.5 to 0.5.
I'll take it.
So convection currents. The planet gets extraordinarily windy, if there's any sort of atmosphere to speak of. And you will lose the atmosphere a little faster than you might want to.
You know what? It sounds petty, but I was thinking that, and then I thought, no, Tim, that sounds stupid. It's too windy. You don't want to lose any more points. And I choked.
It really would be a very important consideration for any planet designers. Your climate is going to affect the inhabitability of your planet. If your planet is too smooth, that's another thing that can cause winds to get everywhere. The Earth has an incredibly complex biosphere, and the variation in Earth's weather is caused by its lovely complex landscape, its variation in height, variation in temperature, and it's large but not, you know, total covering of seas. So these are considerations that one designing a planet would have to make if
you'd think
if we were doing it for real.
Oh, right. Okay.
Which we are.
Okay, so we started to talk about atmospheric science and the atmospheric effects of some of our planets. So we've got an issue here. Let's go to my favourite planet that Stella Firma have designed.
Ooh.
In my in-character persona as Jurek Brynison, King of the Armoured Bears of Svalbard, I ordered a planet myself from the crack design team of Trexel Geisman and David Seven. And what I got was not up to specifications.
Complaints are really not where we...
you have to talk to the legal department.
So let's try and explain the science behind the roaming robot accountants,
yes,
and how exactly they are warming the planet?
Well, because they're radiators, and radiators are warm.
Two plus two equals water.
Well, I think again we've got a slightly a failure of our imagination on in terms of scale here.
Sure,
a planet is very, very large.
There are a lot of accountants.
How big are these robots?
And there are loads
of them. How much heat is each robot generating?
They're regular accountant size. Let's say 5'8". You know, they're not really tall because otherwise they wouldn't have been accountants. So they're about 5 foot. Apologies to any accountants listening. You're very average in height. They're about 5'8". you take that, you averagely heighted people. So they're about 5'8", 180 pounds. I don't know why I used pounds. I have no idea how heavy people are in pounds. 12 and a half stone, let's say. Sort of regular accountants.
Sure.
But there are millions of them.
Millions of them. Like passenger pigeons in pre-19th century America.
I mean, there's what, 7.4, 7.5 billion humans on Earth?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
How much do you think the heat that humans generate contributes to the general atmospheric conditions of the planet Earth? I'm being interrupted.
Take this, Ben.
Please take him down a peg or two, Ben.
Remember what you just said, the amount of heat that humans give off. These accountants are literally radiators.
Actual radiators.
It's in the name. They radiate.
So how hot is each individual accountant?
Well, they're probably, I'd say, about 150 degrees. But what we do is, remember, they were there to make creeks. So what you'd do is you'd group accountants together at the source of a creek you wish to make, and then you would place them at regular intervals just to keep the water flowing.
And I would say there's precedent in nature for this in the humble bee. Consider the humble bee, Bryn, because bees will all cluster together and vibrate in order to create heat for various purposes. One of which is to kill intruders. So if a hornet, say, gets into a bee's nest, they all cluster around the hornet and grab together and vibrate, and the heat cooks the hornet. So that's art imitating life.
I mean, zoology is. A very far cry from my area of expertise, but I have also read this, so I have to concede you a point there, so I suppose.
Fundamentally, what happens is the accountants get around the source of river and just vibrate.
Just vibrate. Yes,
just vibrate.
Their heat is generated by vibration. Did we not mention this?
Yes.
I mean, I think the accountants causing rivers to start flowing, it is realistic. However, I think we really need to bear in mind that the general climate condition of a planet is controlled by how much energy the sun is providing and the thickness and composition of the atmosphere. Unless you're covering your entire planet in a multi-layered city, I'm not sure the actual contents of the planet are going to have a big effect on the overall climate condition.
Okay, thank you.
I was going to give it back to you. I want to say my thing. So consider this. So if it is the case that in this planet it's just over the edge into being icy, there's snow, there's ice in the ground, you know, permafrost, let's say, so it's just over into that. You know, it's not the Arctic, but it's sort of relatively into there. And then you have many, many millions of hot water sources all flowing into the sea. And water has very good thermal... retention ability. If it gets hot, it remains hot for quite a while. So if you have constantly hot water pouring into the sea, even if it's then out, that's gonna raise the overall temperature, and it's gonna remain remain liquid, surely?
Again, the question is scale here.
There's
the temperature
so
of an
many
individual
of them.
River.
I think Bryn is actually missing on the real question, which is how do we power these accountants? Which we never answered. I assume you just plug them in at the wall.
Yeah, you plug them in
which
at the wall.
Which wall? Who knows? But yeah. It's actually their briefcase. They plug themselves in at their briefcase and then...
I do remember that the briefcases being the power sources. That does seem to...
Did they have small nuclear generators? Can't remember.
Yeah. Well, that would be the most sort of stable and long-lasting. Yeah, small onboard power station. And because they're in water, that's the cooling system.
There we go.
Which we do unfortunately get into a slight logical cycle there because they heat the water, but the water is also the cooling system for the battery that allows them to heat the water. So if they're too good, meltdown.
Yeah. I think I see another thing it would be important if we were to understand the real science behind these designs would be to establish how much of the planetary surface is covered by water and how much is covered by land.
So that depends actually on how much the polar bears want to do business.
Yes, how much business do you want to do, Bryn?
Of course. Very little, ideally.
Okay, so only like two or three creeks.
Yeah, two or three creeks.
Just enough to have a few business meetings, but not too much. Now, if you want to do more business... Well,
let's say it's the size of the Earth. You've got Lake Victoria. Everything else is land. You know, it's a lot of water, but in comparison to the size of the planet, not that much.
That is a fair point. Lake Victoria is very small compared to the size of Earth.
That's a true fact, Tim stated there. A true, unequivocal fact.
I can't disagree with you. Okay, so I think you've answered my questions about the polar bear planet. Now, one of your planets did have a significant amount of the surface covered in lava.
All, I believe. Oh, no, apart from the bit that's covered in marmalade.
There was a bit that was also covered in marmalade.
Yes.
Now, early on in the life cycle of a rocky planet, we believe that they were indeed mostly a surface of lava. Mm-hmm. Did you guys have any sort of ballpark estimates of how hot lava is in general?
Ben?
I'd like to go for about 1,200 degrees.
I'm going to go... For it depends on what's melted.
Oh.
I mean, 1,200 degrees is a pretty good number.
Yes.
It's actually at the low end. I mean, obviously,
it
lava, as we think of it...
depends what has melted.
There is a sense of that. I mean, lava is essentially a term for liquid rock. Mm-hmm. Rock. There are different types of rock with different melting points. So, in another sense... I think there's a point each for you there.
Oh, yes.
Now, obviously, lava, as we think of it, is molten rock that has come out above the surface of the Earth and is therefore cooling rapidly. So actually, to say the temperature of lava is a slightly weird thing because it's changing rapidly because it's cooling.
Should we have said the temperature of magma?
Everything. So the temperature of magma, indeed, but can be hotter than 1,200 in fact. And if the entire surface of your planet is lava, then the lava is not hitting other things to cool down. So in fact, an entirely lava-covered planet is likely to be a little bit hotter than lava on Earth. You'll notice that 1,200 degrees, if we're taking that as the temperature figure, which seems reasonable, is not quite within what we referred to earlier as the Goldilocks zone.
I'd prefer you to the fact that everyone who went on that planet died.
Died, yeah, that was part of the design. It was somewhat of a murder planet.
We really pushed it towards Papa Bear on that one.
Yeah. I mean, in that
Beyond
sense...
Beyond Papa Bear, the Goldilocks.
In that sense, the science was accurate. You did make a planet where literally everyone who went there died.
Yeah.
And established that lava is hot.
You know, I thought I was criticising your planetary design skills, but I have no ability to criticise your planetary evaluation skills. They have all been disasters.
So we don't know what we're making, but we know when it's bad.
Yeah, exactly.
Apparently so. I can't remember the mechanism by which you had marmalade existing next to lava.
Well, there's an important point. That the reason you don't remember the mechanism is because we didn't put one in.
Yeah.
Is the short answer. But go on.
Because they entered the planet from, I think, either orbital dropship or a big slide... both of those things are above the surface of the planet. And when you're leaving your kids somewhere, you usually leave them at the entrance, which implies that the marmalade creche is actually not on the surface of the planet.
Good point.
Which is why those children lived to be orphans.
Sure. So the marmalade playpen was in orbit of the planet somehow?
Yeah, probably. Why
on
not?
A dedicated moon or, well, no, or something
there,
of that type.
There is a sort of a mothership that also had quite a large Burns unit.
Yes.
It as well.
Yes, I remember the Burns unit.
An inadequate Burns unit as it transpired.
Yes. Well, you know what? It's a Burns unit, not you've literally liquefied immediately unit. That's not, you're not burnt, you've died.
Oh, yes, that is a different unit.
It's a different unit.
That's entirely fair. Our Burns unit is going to be entirely necessary on a lava planet. So we've talked a lot about the different heating mechanisms we've used for planets, this very important fact about providing energy to the surface of the planet. And now we're going to come. We're running a bit low on time, so we're now going to get onto my own personal biggest problem so far. Miniature suns.
Okay, just very quickly, I am not going to answer any of these questions because I'm pretty sure David's reaction to that is, really? Miniature suns? So I'm with you on this one.
All right, I stand alone.
Okay, so Ben has abdicated all responsibility. So we'll let him attempt to justify miniature suns.
Okay, I have two theories. And I'll start with the one that I feel is more credible.
It's going to blow our goddamn mind.
I'm going to redefine science for you. So a sun is a large object. Doesn't have to be large. You know, actually, my first question to you, base question, is a sun defined by its... Well, a sun is actually not a definition, as I understand it. It's a star. A sun is just what we call our star. So a star isn't defined... Is it defined by its size? Fundamentally. Is there such a thing as this is too small to be a star?
Yes. Now, not inherently. The limit on the size of a star is not just when it gets too small, we call it something else.
Okay.
It's that to be a star, it has to be undergoing the process of nuclear fusion.
Okay, well, I won't let you go any further because this is where my answer lies.
Sure.
So I contend that what happens with a star is that there's so much gravity going on all over the place that it's all really hot and dense, because when things are dense, they're hot. And when they're hot...
Accurate.
Yeah, so when things are dense, they're hot. So it's not about anything other than density. So if the star is made out of a much denser material than your regular-sized star, then despite the fact it's quite small, you've still got that level of density that means it's all melted. And therefore, it's a star.
Tim,
yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Okay, very quickly. You're right about the heat. Yeah. Okay. What's the other property of density that we have talked about earlier on this episode?
I don't remember.
Okay, it's gravity, right? Do you know what happens when you get something that's like so dense?
Have I created a black hole? Is a small star a black hole?
A small, incredibly dense star is, in fact, a black hole.
God damn it! What,
can I just get you to suggest, Tim, how effective a set of miniature black holes would be at providing heat and light to a planet?
I'm going to go out on a limb here and say... Black holes are not conducive to emitting heat and light. They're much more in the business of sucking it in.
I mean, as someone with a master's degree, very specifically in black holes, I totally agree with that statement.
Is there a way I may be asking a question that can't be answered. Is there a way of having a black hole? So there is a point where a star turns from a star into a black hole, or at least where it decides, am I going to be a black hole or am I going to be a red dwarf?
Yes.
What am I doing?
So very, very, very briefly, if a star is essentially too small to become a star at the beginning, then it will be a gas giant. So there are very large gas giant planets. Jupiter, for example, is actually not very far away in the grand scheme of things from being big enough to become a star.
Sure.
Stars get much, much bigger than our sun. They can be huge. Commonly at the end of the life cycle of a star, they do collapse inwards due to their own gravity. And then there are two distinct types of very small, very dense stars. One is called a neutron star. It's not really a star anymore because it's no longer emitting heat and light, but it's called a neutron star and is slightly less dangerous than a black hole. But on the scale we're talking about, the gravitational effect of putting a neutron star or a black hole near a planet would both be extremely apocalyptic, which is not a phrase I thought I would say.
Would it tear your matter apart at its very fundamental level?
Maybe not at the fundamental level, but certainly at the macroscopic level.
Sure.
And possibly, yes.
Your hands would fall
off. Microscopic level.
Okay, I understand.
Yeah, I think your body would be rapidly ripped apart.
So can bacteria survive black holes?
No.
Aww.
The only thing that can survive black holes is atomic matter.
Okay. So when you say micro, you mean...
And
you
when
mean
I really say survive, micro. This is a very complex...
Yeah, because survive is not necessarily... It's a term of life. Like, look, this proton has survived. Well, I mean, it wasn't
I
really
mean, any,
alive.
Anyone who wants to understand Hawking radiation, get in touch with me later and I'll send you a copy of my master's dissertation, because that's really the level we're talking about when we're talking about the relationship black holes have with atomic or subatomic matter. Let's leave that for another time, perhaps. But yes, fundamentally. So Tim, you were about to propose some form of alternative to neutron stars or black holes.
Yes, my alternative is you just take a little scoop of an existing sun. There you go, little sun. Just take a little scoop of it. Like a big ball, like a lemon baller. A lemon baller? A melon baller. And you just sort of like, whoops, there it is. And then, you know, what's it going to do? Run away? It's the sun. It's just a little tiny chunk of sun.
So this is very close to a good idea.
Wow, that's the most shocking thing I've heard.
Wowee! Why is it that my outlandish stupidity is closer to science than my considered answer?
Well, so, I mean, a little ball of sun matter, great, yeah, that's a perfect thing to use as a fuel for a fusion reaction. The problem is, as we said just now, you really need the heat and the density provided by the huge mass of the star to make it hot enough for nuclear fusion to occur, and it's nuclear fusion which gives out that energy.
Sure.
So the issue you've got with your little melon ball of star stuff is that it's a great fuel, but you essentially need to have it reach a certain temperature before it will start producing energy. Now, if you're scooping it directly out of a sun and you can keep it going, I mean, who are we to say what ridiculous sci-fi level technology Stella Firma has access to? If they can make planets, maybe they can. Maybe they can scoop a small ball of star matter directly out of the upper layer of a star and just put it in a containment field and have it be a self-sustaining nuclear fusion reaction.
I have a theory. I have a theory for this. Is there an astronomical thing, and I'm using the science word of thing here, I want to say black hole, but I mean black hole in the terms of sci-fi teleportation hole. Is there a thing through which gravity can act and sort of like they are two separate points in space, but gravity's acting through them as if it's some sort of doorway? Is that a thing?
You're asking if wormholes exist.
Do wormholes exist?
No.
Well, that makes my second half difficult.
Well, we can get into quantum, right?
I mean, it's actually a more complex answer than that. The answer is, if a wormhole began, the laws of physics allow it to continue to exist.
But how does it start is the question.
But how does it start?
Okay.
And currently, we can't think of a way unless you have negative mass, which, as far as we can tell, doesn't exist in the universe.
Sure. Well, let's say you found one. Maybe
I mean,
in the
we
streets.
Have control of we know we have gravitational control technology at Stella Firma Limited.
True. Very
so
true.
Sure. Let's use that to make some negative mass, create a wormhole.
Yeah, yeah.
Fantastic.
Yeah. So we got one. So what you do is you take your little scoop of sun and then you plonk it on top of a wormhole, and the other side of the wormhole is in the existing mother sun. And therefore, it's sort of the gravity and therefore density that you would need. And it's all coming through the wormhole, basically.
Unfortunately, you have just connected your sun via wormhole to your planet. And as previously stated, gravitational effects
will get
transferred through the wormhole.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Pretty
no,
much, yeah.
All right, fair enough.
So,
you know what? If you don't ask, you don't get, Bryn. So,
I mean, again, you're thinking, you're being creative, you're close to a good idea, in fact. So we're practically out of time, but I will mention that the idea that Tim is blindly grasping towards is pretty similar to the nuclear fusion experiments that have been going on for the last 30 to 40 years in terms of generating a self-sustaining nuclear fusion reaction in a reactor on Earth as a form of power generation. Now, this is a technology that we haven't mastered. And, you know, reports have been saying, oh, it's about 30 years away for about 40 years now.
Yeah. And for some reason, those messages are coming from 80 years in the past. Something's gone very... It's real weird over there. Something's wrong.
But there is a form of nuclear fusion technology which essentially takes a bunch of star matter, i.e. mostly hydrogen and helium.
A scoop.
a scoop of star matter, contains it in a very strong magnetic field, which both keeps it in place and causes it to spin. And in theory, if you can get the magnetic field to do both those things strongly enough, you could achieve a contained, self-sustaining fusion reaction. So we're not too far away from our idea of little miniature suns.
There you go. So what you're saying is I'm correct.
I think if we've learned anything in today's special on the science of Stella Firma, it's that you are correct approximately one-fifth as often as Ben is.
That seems about right.
We fit our roles as David and Trexel at that point. Also, it's perfectly viable because, as we know, stellar firma does happen at least 30 years in the future.
Yeah, at least.
So we will have nuclear fusion by
then.
Another good point. Yeah, if fusion technology is 30 years away, we are forced to assume that stellar firma has access to it.
Unless those scientists are liars.
Just a real quick one before we end, because I do appreciate we're out of time. What's time travel and how does it work? Just quickly, how does it time travel? How does it work?
It doesn't.
Okay, well, there you go. Asked and answered.
Thanks, guys. Thanks for joining me today. I hope you enjoyed our little chat. Listeners, let us know what you thought. Let us know if you've got any follow-up questions. I'm generally found hanging around the Discord at all hours of the day and night. And let us know if you enjoyed this special. Maybe we can do another one at the end of the next season if we've got anything more to say. And if any of us have felt like taking the time to prepare notes for that one and actually have the ability to talk about stuff with some knowledge of things that happened more than a week ago.
Well, we can but dream, Bryn. We can but dream.
I imagine that technology is at least 30 years
away,
to be honest.
At least 30.
Yeah, no, certainly, definitely.
But this show does take place to 30 years in the future. So, you know, it's fine.
Thank you very much for joining us, everyone. And I hope we will see you all back for the soon-to-arrive Season 2 of Stella Firma.
Bye, everybody. Have a chill day.
Goodbye, funky people.
Funksters. See?
Bye, guys.
Smooth.
Thank you.
Very smooth.
Hi everyone, it's Imogen, the voice of Imogen from Stella Firma. Today I'm here to tell you about Woe Begone, a podcast launched on the RQ network. Woe Begone is a weekly horror sci-fi audio drama series about the nature of power and the implications of linear time. Woe Begone follows Mike Waters, who discovers a mysterious and violent online game. What begins as an exploration of an alternate reality game with real-life consequences quickly becomes a search for the technology that makes the game possible. Each episode has a unique soundtrack composed by creator and writer Dylan Griggs. Listen to Woe Begone, that's Woe, full stop, Begone, wherever you listen to podcasts, or check out woebegonepod.com for episodes and transcripts. Have fun and see you later.